Hello, listeners. Welcome to Film Club, episode 27. My name is Mel Foster, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host and co-pilot of this fine film vessel, Mr. Daniel Seraph. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. I'm a little bit tired. I need to warn everybody in advance. I only just in the last, 48 hours flown across half the world, so I'm a little bit jet-lagged at the moment. Ramble and stutter and slur my words, then it's not just me being weird, it's probably why.
There you go. Well, at least we know why. Yeah, you've been away transatlantic travelling.
I have, yes.
Back in the UK. You got to see lots of nice, interesting films on the plane, I believe.
I did, yeah. I flew back via Air France, who apparently do things a lot differently
than
British Airways and American Airlines, by which I mean they have, the craziest, most art house film selections ever on, a seatback thing. I was expecting, Jack the Giant Slayer, and instead they, gave me, Takeshi Miike films and, the new, Asghar Farhadi film. So I was like, yeah, this is brilliant. Bring this on. It got all art house up in Air France.
Nice. Other airlines, take note. The film is that we're talking about this week is A Single Man, which is a little bit art housey, in a sense. It's my latest pick. The only film that Tom Ford, fashionista turned mogul turned one-time film director, has made. And that was one of the reasons why I picked it. One of the other reasons, obviously, is because I had very fond memories of it. This is only the second time I've seen it, but from the first time I've seen it, I remember really liking it because it was very stylish, which I do like in my films, but also had quite a bit of substance from what I remembered. And also the idea that, you know, as I mentioned, it's the only film he's made. And I kind of was questioning myself to go back and see if that's a good thing or if it's a shame that he's only made one film. You've seen A Single Man before we've rewatched this, correct?
Yes, I have. I saw it when it came out theatrically in, 2010? I haven't seen it since, though, so it's been good revisiting it.
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons why I picked it, because I haven't seen it since it came out theatrically. It was 2009, I think, or it was early 2010, one of the two. But yeah, I'm really pleased I went back to it, because I actually really enjoyed watching it again the second time.
I did too, not as much as... I remember really, really loving this film. Mm-hmm. And at the time I put it in, one of my favourite films of the year, and I had very, very fond memories of it, like you. And I did really, really enjoy it, but it's one of those kind of incidents of a film not quite being as good as I remember it, though still being great at the same time. But I guess we should start on the positive notes first, because it is a very good film. I mean, one of the fascinating things about it, I guess before we talk about the film itself, is the actual making of it, because it is Tom Ford's only film. You know, he did, self-finance it himself. He was very passionate about Christopher Isherwood's novel, and he himself being a gay male, obviously related to the story of this English professor who's kind of quietly going through the grief of losing his partner. He obviously related to a lot of the issues in the story a lot, and I think it's quite admirable that, you know, he did feel so passionately about it and basically just kind of endeavoured himself to, you know, to bring it to the big screen himself and, you know, do it the way he wanted to see it done as a fan of the novel and as a fan of the story. And I think that's really refreshing to see, especially the fact that he kind of put up his own money for it, you know, in an age of, Kickstarter and crowdfunding and so many filmmakers kind of relying on audiences to kind of pay for films that they want to make. I think it's kind of cool that Tom Ford, you know, just kind of had this passion project and put the money down himself and made it.
Oh, that's exactly the best term to use, because it is a passion project. As you said, this is obviously stemming from a novel from which he has connected with and he's kind of found a real love for. And has wanted to kind of flesh it out and visualise it. And he could have gone a number of roles. I mean, he could have got somebody else to direct it, but I like the fact that he has, like you say, raised the money himself, put it into himself, and has kind of took charge of it himself, because it obviously is a very personal film to him, and you kind of get that. You feel that from the sort of craft that goes into the film, I think.
Oh, you do, absolutely. I mean, some of the, in fact, easily the best moments of the film are some of the moments where you can tell that Tom Ford's really related to certain moments. It's kind of like in its portraits of how it kind of captures what it's like to be, this kind of repressed, like homosexual male who's like unable to kind of come out and be who he wants to be. I mean, one of the outstanding scenes of the film is very early on, when the main character George has a phone call with his partner's cousin, I think it is, who informs him that Jim, his partner, has died over the phone. And just the way it kind of captures that scene, and he's not invited to the funeral by Jim's parents, and he's sort of left to kind of suffer alone. And like, this is obviously things that Tom Ford, though maybe not directly, has gone through, relates to so well. And the way he directs it is obviously very, he does feel, very close to the subject, and it does really elevate a lot of the scenes in the film. The fact that, he obviously is so passionate about some of the ideas and themes and things that it presents in the film.
It's a really interesting scene you pull up, because it was one of my favourite moments in the film, because it really is quite heartbreaking, because you do, it's you can't even imagine to receive such horrible news in such an impersonal manner, and yet you want to share in other people's grief, you want to have the company of people around you, and yet this huge sort of defensive shield is placed in front of him, and he's sort of blocked out and sort of exiled from that because of his relationship with Jim, and it's incredible, and it's such a simple thing, and yet it's so powerful. And I think that's one of the things that I really like about this film, is that it does a lot of little subtle things, and there's a lot of subtle mechanics in the film, but they have a lot of sort of resonating effect.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I really like about the film is still the kind of opening sequence in which George, quote unquote, becomes George. And it's such a kind of powerful portrait of what it is, be it homosexual or any kind of, as he later describes in the film, any kind of minority who kind of feels like they have to kind of repress who they really are in the face of society. And, he kind of becomes what's expected of him because he's so afraid of being himself. And it is such like a simple thing, this kind of montage of him shaving in the morning and putting on his suit and becoming this kind of image of who he wants to present to the world. And but it's so simple, but it's so effective, like you said.
It's just a simple sort of precision movements to become what is expected, and the perception that other people have of him, and to kind of fit in essentially. And it is quite sad. There's a real sort of melancholic tone to it, and it's something that obviously, given the subject matter of the film, is pretty rife. It's a pretty sad film from start to finish. But it kind of, I think the film really kind of captures its essence and its tone straight away. I mean, right from the opening titles, it's a moody affair. And it just really protrudes this really haunting sense of melancholy through the start, and even though obviously the tone changes with the introduction of Nicholas Holt's character, who I actually forgot Nicholas Holt was in this film until I seen him again. Obviously he kind of alleviates a bit of light, and the shift in focus changes a little bit, as does Julianne Moore's character at times. But I think from the get-go, it really does a fantastic job at establishing just how emotional and just how sort of impactful the film is.
It's one of the kind of, I mean, I do have a little bit of, I do have flaws with Tom Ford's direction, and it kind of inevitably so, because he isn't necessarily a filmmaker. But one of the things I was really impressed with, and especially going back this time, is, it's one thing to just be able to kind of put a camera in a scene and film the actors, but to actually kind of capture the kind of tone and mood, that's something that I think is the kind of trademark of a real talented filmmaker. And the fact that Tom Ford does that so well in the film is really quite extraordinary. I mean, it's not just melancholic. I mean, there are some very kind of funny moments in the film too, amid the kind of melancholia. And I remember, I only remember this when I was watching the film today, actually, that I remember the first time I watched it, kind of going into the film, not really knowing much about the story and finding it very kind of tense and sinister, because I mean, it's kind of alluded to very early on in the film that obviously the story is kind of about George kind of preparing for his own death, but very early on you kind of get the sense that, you know, it's kind of, it leaves it kind of open to the idea that he's maybe not kind of preparing to kill himself, but maybe kill other people.
Really?
And so you do have this kind of, I got that through the film. Like, this is scene early on when he drives past like the neighbor's house, and there's like the young kid in the garden who kind of points a toy gun at him, and he kind of aims very precisely with his fingers and like takes dead aim at this like kid with his with like this pretend gun. And it's like, it's a very sinister scene, I thought. And it, I think it kind of leaves it open, at least early on in the film, to the fact that, you know, whether he's committing suicide or if his final day is this kind of like mass kind of carnage thing, that he's just so unhappy and depressed. I mean, obviously by the time he gets to the middle of the film, it kind of, you know, you do realize George's intentions, but there is something kind of sinister, I think, like early on in the film, and something kind of really dark and suspenseful.
I've never actually kind of picked up on that, but I can kind of see where you're coming from a little bit, because he does, as the film goes on, he does kind of seem a little bit like a man who's kind of sick and angry at the world because of the way it judges him, and the sort of circumstances which have pressed upon him. I've never really picked up on that, but actually going back and thinking about it, that kind of does make a bit of sense, especially with
the kid
with
the gun. Going in without,
or maybe you've just got a crazy kind of homicidal mind.
And I was just like, what is this? Is this like some kind of like elephant Gus Van Sant film? but yeah, no, I kind of got that. But I mean, the fact that kind of Tom Ford, well, at least I think there's a sinister undertone to it, but the fact that kind of he's able to balance so many kind of different kind of moods and tones in the film, I think is quite a talented thing for him to be able to do. It's something that I don't think a lot of first-time filmmakers could achieve quite as well as he did.
It's funny because there is a mix of emotions. I mean, whether you do look at the melancholy of it or the potential sinister homicidal streak that's in there, or the sort of really uplifting bit, because strangely enough, for a film that is sort of coldly centred around death, both the death of Jim and the potential death of George, and even more so now the potential death of children who live next door and anyone else in George's way, it's actually kind of uplifting, because it's almost, and a big part of this is attributed to the sound design of the film, which I really liked, is it's almost as if, though George knows it's his last day, as if he's getting closer to death, that he finally begins to appreciate the little things in life. And you get to see this through, sometimes it's a little bit obvious with some of the close-ups and slow motion stuff that Ford does, but I think it's a nice little nuance, and I think it sinks in really nicely with the sound design, because you can hear often throughout the score and throughout the sort of body of sound that accompanies the visuals, you can hear a heartbeat speeding up and slowing down, and it's almost, and the more I think about this, maybe that kind of does tie into your idea that perhaps he's planning on killing other people, and it's like the rush of noticing the detail of people and the detail of life before he takes it away. Yeah. I don't know, but it's almost like a real sort of stylistic way of getting inside the mind of the actor through the camera and the technical setup of the film, essentially.
Yeah, I like the way you kind of use colour to kind of do the same thing as well. I mean, it's quite a washed out film for a lot of it, and then like the colour will kind of gradually change in certain scenes as like his kind of perception of the world gets a little bit warmer and brighter, and so does, you know, the kind of color hue of the film. You know, there's a scene early on where he's kind of he's walking through the college campus and he sees like a group of shirtless tennis players playing, and the color just kind of very gradually kind of turns a little bit warmer. And when he's kind of talking to Nicholas Holt for the first time in the film, you see it then as well, and it's quite an interesting little touch he does, and it kind of does tie into the idea that he is sort of having this, he kind of wants to have a perfect day almost, like before he kind of takes his own life.
Exactly.
And he does sort of appreciate these little things. I like the scene where he, I think it's maybe his secretary who he approaches on like the very first thing in the morning. Yes. And he decides to tell her how beautiful she looks.
Yeah.
And it's amid all the kind of very sad moments at the start of the film, when you see his reaction to Jim's death, you see, you know, the aftermath of the car crash, you see, you know, him kind of preparing himself that he, you know, wants to compliment this girl on on a look someone he probably just passes by in the corridor every day. It's a sweet kind of just like little humanist little touch to the film that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think the film for me, because as a big scale, it doesn't really offer an awful lot, especially in terms of narrative structure or sort of arc or development. There isn't like a great sort of point from one point to the other. It doesn't really take a huge shape and develop and have loads of layers. But it is a film which really kind of taps into little nuances and little mechanics and just little bits and pieces. And I think that's what makes it such a wonderful film, is that it kind of takes the time to look closer at the smaller things that perhaps we all kind of take for granted and what have you, and kind of puts a microscope over the mundane and kind of makes it really interesting.
Yeah, I still do think that, and this kind of comes onto my criticism of the film. I guess I'll start by with like a little bit of a nitpick, but like I'm going to get a bigger point here.
Okay.
There's a kind of running theme through the film that George is kind of quote unquote not looking so good, and he's told it by, I think Charlie tells him, his maid tells him, I think even, I'm trying to remember what his name is, Lee Pace's character. His kind of fellow college professor tells him as well. But when you kind of look at the film and you look at George and Colin Firth, he definitely doesn't not look good. Like, if he really doesn't look like shit at all. And I know that that sounds like I'm being a little bit picky, but I think it kind of gets to the bigger issue is that there's so much in the film looks a little bit too pretty. Yeah. Like, it looks like a bit of like a perfume Chanel No. 5 advert at times. Everything just looks, everything and everyone looks so immaculate. There's a scene when he first walks onto the campus and he kind of walks in like towards this kind of wave of students coming towards him, and every single one of them are like tan, skinny, you know, great looking guys and girls in like great looking clothes, and everything just looks so perfect in the film. And I kind of feel like for a film that deals with such a messy issue, such as like death and fear and repression, like it just seems a little bit, I don't know, it seems a little bit like we need some kind of rough around the edges in a film that Tom Ford doesn't provide. And maybe that just comes from his background as a fashion designer.
I was
going to
say, maybe that's it just comes with his territory, and maybe that's just like a natural thing that clings on. And I can see that as a valid point, and I'd agree. I think, you know, perhaps if the film let itself go a little bit and kind of embraced more of a sort of rugged look in places instead of just having like a model agency's roster on campus.
Yeah, exactly.
Then perhaps it kind of would have struck a little bit deeper in the terms of looking at the everyday and the sort of connection to the common man, because it does look very pretty. It looks very cosmetic.
It does. I think that's kind of my problem. It just looks a bit too fake for me, and it sort of slightly takes me out of the film a little bit. But like I said, I think that was maybe just something that comes with, that kind of Tom Ford kind of brings along with him, just maybe, you know, unknowingly, from his background of, you know, making people look as great as they can. You know, his natural impulse seems to be to make everything look absolutely immaculate and perfect. So it's not so much a criticism against his work, it's just something that I kind of find a little bit off-putting about the film.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a totally valid point.
Yeah, that's about it.
Was that your nitpicky bit, or do you have...
That's my little nitpicky bit. It's I don't know. That's just like the one little thing that kind of like restraint, like holds me back from really loving the film.
Do you have any further problems with the film?
I don't really. I remember the first time I watched it, I was a little bit dismayed by Nicholas Hoult, but I actually really like him in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for all the performances. I mean, what do you think about Colin Firth? Because obviously he was kind of at one point sort of the front runner for an Oscar for this role, and then ended up losing it to, was it Jeff Bridges?
Yeah, because it was,
and he's like, I think he's doing absolutely incredible in.
Well,
in
I anybody that listens to the podcast and has listened to it in previous incarnations, I know that I wasn't exactly the biggest fan of The King's Speech, for which Colin Firth did win his Best Performance Actor nod. I actually think he deserves it much more for this, and it's even from the first 10 minutes alone. I think it comes across that he should have won it for this, because he just, I don't know. There's so many multifaceted aspects to the character and the way that he puts it across. Because it's one thing to play emotionally torn and heartbroken, but it's another to really convincingly mask it. And you get the impression, like when you're watching it, you do get the, even though you know that he's hiding and suppressing all of these feelings, he does an amazing job at masking it and kind of playing cool. Even though inside he knows that his character just wants to break into a thousand pieces, and to be able to kind of balance both of those sort of portrayals and personas is something that's really hard to do, and it takes somebody who is fantastic at their craft and somebody who knows their character in immense detail to do. And you get that impression within the first 10 minutes, and it's just a sheer joy to watch in terms of acting. Because he just plays it note perfect from start to finish. And he's a really engaging presence as well, because you kind of feel like he has, even though he's pretty much given up after the death of Jim, you feel like he is somebody that has so much to give. And especially his interactions with Nicholas Holt, because you sense that he almost has like a mentor role at one point, and you kind of feel like, well, he could offer so much to this young man and to other people as well, and you kind of feel a sense of sadness with that, but he does such a wonderful job that, yeah, I feel he should have won it for this performance.
I do too. I kind of, on some level, I kind of hope the King's Speech Oscar win was like a kind of like, well, we got it wrong. We should have given it to you instead of Jeff Bridges, so here's one for the King's Speech instead. But like, I kind of feel I'm always a little bit like torn with Colin Firth because he always does such kind of like he can kind of swing from doing incredible stuff to doing absolutely terrible stuff. And I notice it so much in this film. Like, I think he's just a really subtle actor, and it doesn't translate when he does things like Saint Trinian's 2 and Mamma Mia and Love Actually and Bridget Jones. Like, but then you see like the actual like the talent that he can bring when he, you know, he's given, I guess, like the kind of role that really suits his kind of acting style, as he's given in A Single Man. And, you know, that kind of restraint, kind of just holding everything back, but letting just enough go to kind of, you know, let the audience in and see what's kind of under the surface, but never too much. Like, I think that's just like real talent that Colin Firth has for doing that. And I totally agree. I think he should have won the Oscar for it.
He's a real, in the character itself as well, and the performance, it's a real sort of knack of making characters that perhaps wouldn't perhaps work either on their own or with other people as well. Because I like Julianne Moore, and her performance in this is good, but the character I don't particularly care for, and she's actually made somewhat infinitely more interesting and more tolerable because of the balance that she has with George. I think had you been exposed to her more on her own or with somebody else who didn't quite have the sort of reflective ability that Firth puts into the performance, then she might have been even more unbearable. But they work pretty well.
I actually forgot that she was in the film until I watched it again. I was like, oh yeah, Julianne Moore's in it, and I love Julianne Moore, so that's maybe not a good thing. But still, I know I think there's a great chemistry between, particularly the kind of Colin Firth and Julianne Moore, and Colin Firth and Nicholas Hoult, and even maybe like Colin Firth and Matthew Good for the small role that he's in it. And you know, he has kind of cast those kind of four roles so perfectly in the kind of in the way they orbit George. Yeah, I think the casting and the acting pretty much uniformly is great in A Single Man.
There you go. I mean, I don't think I have anything else to say about it, because I think we've kind of covered most of it from my perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's quite a thorough look at A Single Man.
Would you be interested to see Tom Ford do any more directing work? I suppose it's an interesting question to ask.
I would, because I really like a lot of what he did. Not everything that he did, as I said, but a lot of what he did in Single Man is really impressive. The thing is, it's one of the cases of like a director doing something that is so kind of it's so distinctive to him, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah,
You
no.
know, you can't like, kind of imagine, in a way that you can kind of imagine someone like, say, Ben Affleck going on and doing another film, and he's kind of got this kind of broad style of, and this kind of broad range of what he's good at, and you can say the same for like David Fincher and people like that. He's one of those directors who, you know, he just kind of made something so kind of personal and so kind of specific and so like kind of quintessentially kind of Tom Ford with a single man that it seems kind of weird to think about him making something else, but I would love to see it because, like I said, there's so much that's good about A Single Man.
I think it would have to be the right project. It would have to be something that he was passionate about, because he obviously really excels when he is using material that he cares about. And like we said, you can clearly tell that he does care about the story and getting it across the way that he does. So I think it would have to be something that he has like a real high amount of passion for, and something that he has creative control over, which, you know, in this industry isn't always easy to obtain and achieve, but I think he's proven that he can do good things with the right material. And I would like to see him do more, because I think he's got a nice little finesse and a nice visual flair. And I think a lot of that does come from his background. But also, you know, thinking about some of the points that you raised, I would also maybe like to see him maybe get a little bit scruffier with his presentation.
Absolutely.
And kind of learn to leave behind the perfectionist aspect a little bit. You know, go a bit rough, go a bit rugged, but keep the finesse and the details and learn
absolutely
to learn to compromise. But yeah,
exactly. Just the balance between the two, that's all we want.
But I would love to see him do more. Whether he does or not, I don't know. If he doesn't and this is his only film, it's a wonderful film for him to have only done. But yeah, there you go. Let us know what you thought of A Single Man at screeninvasion.com, or you can jump on over to Facebook and look for Screen Invasion on there, and you can find a film club forum as well. You can also find a full list of all the other films that we've covered so far over at Letterboxd, which if you haven't joined up to, do so, because both me and Dan are over there. But I will put the link of the list of all the films that we've covered so far. So if you are just jumping into the wonderful, wonderful thing that is Film Club and you want to catch up, or you just want to cherry pick some of the films that we've covered and talk about them in specific, you can do so, because I'll leave the list in the show notes for this post at screeninvasion.com. Also, if you want to sort of influence how the show is shaped in the future, you can, by suggesting films for us to watch, which leads me to my next point. Dan's picked a film for this round, I've picked a film for this round, so it's up to you, the listener, to pick a film for this round. And if you are new to the show, then let me introduce you to our wonderful high-tech aspect of democracy. It is a little plastic tube which has got like fingerprint smudges and stuff all over it now. And basically, you suggest a film, I write it on a bit of paper, I scrunch it up into a ball and throw it in there. And that is the modern technological era that we live in, boys and girls. So if you want to suggest a film for us to watch, do so at screeninvasion.com or at the Facebook forums. And it will go into the little plastic smudgy tumbler, and then it might just end up being the next film we watch. But so that's what we're doing now. We're going to pick our next film from the tumbly box. The last film to be added was The Hunt, or Jagten, I think is how you pronounce it. Or is it Jagten? Would it be a Jag with it being Danish?
Maybe a Jag. Yeah, maybe
it might be a Jag.
maybe a Jag or it's a Jag.
It's a Mads Mikkelsen film which came out last year or the year. It was last year, wasn't it?
European release was the end of last year. It's not long been out on the in stateside though. I think it maybe hit VOD though, so it should be pretty widely available.
So pretty new.
If that one should come out of the Tumblr, what else have we got in there? Did we?
I know that we've got Silence of the Lambs, because that's the one that I think then it always kind of anticipates.
That's the bullet. Yeah, it's the one that I always have. I am always on tenderhooks. I always
that's
fear
the one,
that one.
That's the one bullet in the empty chamber of this cinematic Russian roulette that Ben doesn't want to see come out. I don't know what else is in there.
Do you have Jaws in there still?
I think Jaws is in there.
I think maybe Blow Up's in there too.
There's a whole bunch of stuff. Honestly, I can't remember what is in there. I think Kids is in there, the Harmony Korine film. Which I think our very own Gwen Reyes suggested we put in there. I can't remember. There's a whole bunch of stuff, and that's what always makes this bit exciting, is because I have forgotten so many things that are in there that it literally could be anything at this point. But let's give it a little rumble, and then we'll spill one out, and we'll see what our next film is. So we've gone from silent cinema to fashionista 60s... melancholy. Who's next? Let's have a look. Oh, too many have fallen out. I've got one though. Oh, the suspense. Always a killer. It is.
Oh.
It's like the lottery, not as prosperous. This is Spinal Tap.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, I didn't know we had that in there,
Nice.
but that is
I
what.
didn't know we had that in there, but I am totally up for that.
Exactly. If you haven't seen it before, now is the perfect excuse and opportunity to watch it. Quite possibly one of the best comedy films ever made, I would say. Straight off the
Yeah,
bat.
I'd agree with you.
Very much made its way into cultural lexicon for a lot of pop culture, and still even today kind of resonates in certain things. But I'm really looking forward to that. It's been quite some time since I've seen This Is Spinal Tap.
I watched it a few months ago, actually. I don't know why. I just was like, I'm in a Spinal Tap mood, so I'm going to put it on. And I would very happily watch it again tonight, so that's a great pick.
Exactly. I will put the link to the IMDb page. If you are none the wiser about it, you can find the link in the show notes for this episode at screeninvasion.com. But the quick rundown is it's a Rob Reiner film written by the one and only Mr. Christopher Guest, who frankly is just, in my mind, a genius of comedy. And came out in 1984. Good God, 1984. Nearly 30 years ago. Can you believe that? So there you go. That is your next film. This is Spinal Tap. And I, for one, am looking forward to it very much so.
I am too. I'm already laughing at some of the jokes. I'm so excited.
Oh, I'm not even going to start referencing it because we could be here for another extended half an hour. But there you go. Go find it. It is widely available. And if you haven't seen it, you have no excuse now. Go watch it and go laugh yourself silly. And then come back in 2 weeks and we'll talk all about it. In which we shall have a good old time. But then I think that's it for this episode. Other than that,
Yeah, I think so.
go watch and enjoy, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.